I grew up in a Jewish community where anything connected to Germans was anathema. I went to Abby Hoffman's memorial service wearing peace sign earrings and a tie-dye t-shirt. And now I go to Germans and plead for them to immediately send all possible lethal weapons to Ukrainians. And I do that without feeling that I'm a very different person or even that my values have changed.
This is Amiel Handelsman, and you're listening to How My View Grew, the show that dives deep into humanity's challenges by looking at big thinkers who have changed their minds. This is the second and last episode in the show's first season. We'll return with season two in the fall. The war between Ukraine and Russia is now well into its third year. In an earlier episode, we heard Ukrainian civic activist Valery Pekar tell the backstory behind Ukraine's extraordinary resilience.
We believe that this is exactly what European values are. Not to close your eyes if someone suffers, and to do this with enough respect to let these people to feel dignity.
It was the tale of a country and a people going through two major shifts in worldview since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and how this prepared them for the moment when Russia made its full-scale invasion in 2022. This week, we hear a different yet complementary story. It comes from an American historian named Marcy Shore. Whereas Valerie described the people's evolution from within, Marcy helps us consider the moral responsibilities facing people living outside of Ukraine. Marcy Shore teaches modern European intellectual history at Yale. She is an expert in Eastern Europe and has devoted great energy in helping outsiders understand what's been happening in Ukraine. I first came across her name in a book called Thinking the 20th Century by the late historian Tony Judt in conversation with Yale historian Timothy Snyder. That book will feature prominently in this episode, but its initial function was to prompt me to learn more about Marcy. Her book, The Ukrainian Night, about the Maidan Revolution in Ukraine a decade ago, impressed me with its personal accounts of dozens of Ukrainians. While reading it, I felt like I was really getting to know these people, which is not how history books always feel. And what I learned is how each of these Ukrainians, at some point, made a pivotal decision to step into history, to take responsibility for their country and for its people, and in many cases, to put their bodies and their lives on the line. That is one reason I wanted to tell Marcy's story here. The second reason is that I've been deeply influenced by Tony Judt, the late historian I just mentioned, and was looking for someone who could describe how his work had shaped theirs. In 2015, The New Yorker published an essay of Marcy's titled Reading Tony Judt in Wartime Ukraine. The essay describes how, in the middle of war, Ukrainians were reading Judt's books and joining him in asking powerful questions like, can we change the world for the better? And do intellectuals matter? And if so, how? This left me wondering, how did Judt's work and life influence Marcy's? And what might we learn from this about people living in countries at war, making the choice to risk their lives, and also, and just as importantly, about citizens halfway around the world facing the choice of what public stand, if any, to take? Let me tell you my own perspective. It is and has been very clear from the beginning. Support Ukraine. Arm Ukraine. Give Ukraine what it needs to fight against Russia. And I've chosen to donate money, more than I would have expected, and do my small part to support Ukrainian friends navigating life in wartime. The reason I've done these things is not only for the sake of Ukrainians, although that should be reason enough, but also for the sake of my older son. Arming Ukraine now makes it less likely that Putin will send Russian troops into NATO countries that my country, the United States, is bound to defend. This, in turn, makes it less likely that in 3 years, when my older son turns 18, he will get sent to Europe to fight the Russians. So it's about both moral responsibility and self-interest. Now, on to Marcy Shore's story. As a young historian, Marcy focused her attention on Eastern Europe.
For me, I was the generation who came to Eastern Europe because of the drama of 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, in the sense that something had been closed was opened, and that point of departure determined my whole, entryway into those conversations. But I was captivated very early by the dissidents of the 70s and 80s, and this idea of speaking the truth. And I was very interested in this motif or this eternal question of the role of the intellectual.
So early in her career, Marcy was already concerned with the moral responsibility of individuals in history, especially in the face of totalitarian regimes. Yet her focus was Eastern Europe, and she was not one to engage in harsh critique of other intellectuals. For this reason, when she came across the work of Tony Judt, both his focus and his tone surprised and intrigued her. One book of Judt's that deeply struck her was Past Imperfect,
which was about the French intellectuals, and in particular the circle around Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir in the post-war years. And that was also a devastating book, extremely sharp.
In Past Imperfect, Judt harshly critiques Sartre's silence about the evils of Soviet communism, like the show trials that put innocent people to death. When Judt made this critique, it was in many ways an audacious act.
There was a sense that Sartre, for so long, had been the closest thing that Europeans had to God, and he had just devastated him. And the condemnation and the viciousness was startling to many people. And I was fascinated by that book, in part because I was fascinated by that circle of intellectuals, but I was also fascinated by what was so compelling. What grabbed people? What seduced them? And not just a couple people and not just a couple stupid people, but in fact, extraordinary numbers of the best and the brightest minds around a huge swath of the globe for a very long time.
Marcy here is referring to intellectuals whose response to the evils and abuses of Soviet communism was either to turn a blind eye toward them or to invent various rationalizations for them.
And so there was this story of what happened in France, which was a story I didn't know as well as the stories I do in Eastern Europe, because I was being trained as a Slavicist. I was a historian of Eastern Europe. But these were also very famous, very revered people. And so I was captivated by his tone, by just how intimate that book was, and by some of the motifs he picks up, like betrayal, and also by the issues laid bare. What were the moral dilemmas of engagement? What were the moral imperatives? When was it better to be silent than to make a choice that you believed was right but turns out to be wrong?
Right. Now, for our listeners who weren't alive then or aren't very familiar with Sartre and the French intellectuals, what were Tony's critiques in particular?
Yeah, so this is a circle of philosophers who were really coming from the same generation as the generation I was writing about in my dissertation. So people who were born around the turn of the century or just after the turn of the century, the first decade of the 1900s, who were the best and the brightest minds. And they, at a certain point, become captivated by Marxism in general and by the Soviet communist experiment in particular. And in the French case, in the 1930s, their hearts are all on the left, but it's really the experience of the Second World War that makes them feel that the world is divided into two camps. You have Nazism, and you have the Soviet experiment, and you have to make a choice one way or the other. There aren't really any other choices. And the pathetic weakness of liberal bourgeois democracy in the face of Nazism effectively made that no longer a viable option. Now, Neville Chamberlain sells out Czechoslovakia at Munich.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler.
Neville Chamberlain was the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. In September of 1938, he signed an agreement in Munich giving a region of Czechoslovakia to Nazi Germany. This is now considered the archetypal case of appeasement.
We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
At the time, to many observers, it made liberalism as a whole seem pathetically weak, making communism the only viable alternative to fascism.
You know, in 1945, it's the Red Army who liberates Prague. France falls in a day, basically, not exactly a day, but doesn't hold up very well. You know, and so it turns out that liberal bourgeois democracy is no defense against fascism. You know, and so the only hope then that they see for mankind is a Soviet experiment. So coming out of World War II, this circle of intellectuals around a famous journal then that they start publishing, in which Sartre opens the discussion with a long essay about what it means for literature to be engagé, to take a position. They are all, and some of them change their minds sooner rather than later, what we call fellow travelers. And fellow travelers is a translation of a Russian expression, which means sympathizers. Sympathizers with communism. And the reason why that phrase is important is because what it meant to be a communist was to be a card-carrying member of the Communist Party. It was not like registering as a Democrat or Republican that you sign a little form and that allows you to join the primaries. You know, to be a member of the Communist Party was a deep existential life choice. Not everybody was accepted. It meant, in Leninist terms, to be a member of an elite conspiratorial vanguard, devoting one's life to bringing about the revolution. So not everybody was a member of the party. You know, most people who sympathized were not members of the party. And if you were a sympathizer who was not actually a communist, who didn't have a right to call themselves a communist because you didn't have a party card, then you were a fellow traveler. So this was a book about fellow travelers.
Marcy is still referring to Jutte's book, Past Imperfect.
And these fellow travelers, moreover, were in France, meaning they were not actually experiencing communism in power. They were looking at it from a distance. And in particular, they were coming out of the Second World War, you know, as fellow travelers, at a moment when Stalinism was coming to power outside of the Soviet Union in the Eastern Bloc. And so literally at this moment, as France is recovering from Nazi occupation, the friends and colleagues and fellow philosophers and writers, some of whom they knew personally, you know, in places like Czechoslovakia, are being put on Stalinist show trial and executed.
Say more about the show trial, what that is.
So the show trial was a particular genre of trial that Stalin had perfected in the mid-1930s during the height of the Stalinist terror in the Soviet Union. And it involved accusing people, often communist, often card-carrying members of the Communist Party, often people who had devoted their lives to this party, of having been spies, of having been traitors, of having conspired with Western imperialists to subvert and undermine the interest of the glorious, peace-loving people of the Soviet Union. There's a very strong motif, not just of having committed a crime, but of having betrayed and betrayal, of having actually secretly the whole time been working against the thing you thought you believed in. People were arrested. They were subjected to gruesome and extensive torture. Confessions were tortured out of them. These trials were rehearsed. They were profoundly performative. You know, and then they were broadcast and publicized everywhere. So this is very much trial as performance, in which essentially the only evidence is an elaborate, dramatic, self-flagellating confession by the accused of his own guilt. And they were essentially orgies of bloodlust in a certain way. And you can think about them in some ways like that they functioned a bit like lynchings functioned in the South, that you have everybody gathered around shouting for the immediate execution of the accused. And the French basically let it go.
In other words, Sartre and the French intellectuals around him did nothing in support of the people being unjustly punished. And there is a reason why.
there was a sense that to speak out against the Soviet Union, to speak out against these communist regimes that had been installed, was to betray the working class, and who had a right to do that. And so there's a chapter of that book, Past Imperfect, called The Blood of Others, you know, and the sense that you have sold out your friends and colleagues, and you're not the one suffering. They are. You have decided to sacrifice them, and you're not standing in solidarity. And you must know they're innocent.
This is Tony critiquing.
This is Tony critiquing the French intellectuals who are not living under under communism and power. And so
right.
It's very easy for them to say, like, okay, we need to make these sacrifices, even if there are some injustices, you know, on behalf of the glorious future for the working class, because they're not the ones who themselves are making the sacrifices.
Right. One of the things I picked up from Tony's writing is that he's looking at a vast array of intellectuals, some of whom respond as these French intellectuals do, but others say, no, that's wrong. I can't stand behind that. In other words, people are making choices. So you have Sartre and that crowd being apologists for show trials and Stalinism. But what is the alternative?
And for Tony, there is an alternative. And the alternative was Camus. The alternative was Raymond Aron.
Albert Camus was a French philosopher whose books included The Stranger and The Plague. Raymond Aron was a French political scientist and journalist.
The alternative were the ones who broke away and insisted on responsibility. And responsibility in his follow-up book, which in some sense is a response to Past Imperfect, is called The Burden of Responsibility. You know, and it's an essay about these intellectuals who did take responsibility, you know, and did pay a cost. You know, and that was he was working out his relationship to the French, but he was also working out his relationship to himself. I mean, I think Past Imperfect can be read as autobiographically. I think it can be read as an extended self-criticism, that he had been a young leftist student, that he had been one of those in Paris in May 1968, jumping up and down and chanting Ho Chi Minh, you know, that he had been raised in a climate in which Marxism was just part of the air you breathed. Everybody's heart was on the left. And it's only when he's in his 30s that he meets contemporaries, people from his own generation, from that generation of 68, who have essentially been expelled from Poland in the wake of the events of that year. And then he realizes that he hadn't understood. And then he feels like what he was saying as a 20-year-old in 1968 was effectively betraying, you know, the people who would become his friends as he began to enter middle age, and he had understood nothing about their experience.
Marcy is describing a distinction that Jutt made between someone like himself protesting in 1968 in Paris at very little personal risk, and colleagues he would later meet who, in that very same year, 1968, had been beaten and imprisoned in Poland and other parts of Eastern Europe. Jutt felt a great moral responsibility to these friends. Indeed, this theme of moral responsibility was core to Judd's work and life. One place it shows up is in the book Thinking the 20th Century, which Jutt wrote with Timothy Snyder as Jutt's physical condition was deteriorating due to the disease ALS. The book is both a memoir of Jutt's intellectual development over the decades and an intellectual history of the 20th century. It's filled with wise and provocative reflections. I asked Marcy to comment on some of them. The first quote from the book that I read out loud to Marcy is Timothy Snyder speaking to Jutt. Due to a note reading error on my part, I mistakenly told her it was Jutt speaking, so she responded accordingly. And the truth is that Jutt says very similar things in the book. Here's the quote I read to her. History's fundamental ethical responsibility is reminding people that things actually happened. Deeds and suffering were real. People lived thusly, and their lives ended in such and not other ways.
Yeah. No, that had a huge influence on me. When I met Tony, I was very enamored of a lot of postmodern theory, and Tony was very much a critic of it. Tony was extremely harsh and vicious, and thought people like Derrida and Foucault have only contributed to the general degradation of the planet. But there was an insistence he had on an ontological distinction between truth and falsehood and good and evil, that even at the height of my fascination with postmodernism, I was deeply drawn to, and it was one of the things that I had been so drawn to when I was immersed in the dissident literature of the 70s and 80s. And in one of the last lectures I heard him give when he was at Indiana, he came to Indiana to give a lecture when I was teaching there, and he was talking about the 20th century, and he said, if you can't use the word evil, if we've decided that that's all a language game, or that's all a matter of a kind of fluid subjective position, then you'll have a really hard time understanding what happened in the 20th century. And that really stuck with me, and I keep coming back to that. I found myself recently in an interview I was giving, about Ukraine. And somebody said, "Well, what does it mean now to talk about, to talk about that quote unquote evil that is happening in Ukraine?" And I said to the interviewer, it was done in correspondence, I said, "The first thing I would do is I would take evil out of the scare quotes. Because it's not so-called evil, because there is such a thing as evil." And Tony was always reminding us that the danger of this theory, which in some ways I found like it was kind of intellectual acrobatics.
Early in Marcy's career, and especially before she got deeply into Judd's work, she was quite enamored of postmodern thinking.
I felt like it was pushing my mind. It was making me think of things I wouldn't have thought of. But that you always have to remember that there is such a thing, as things that really happened as opposed to things that did not happen. There is such a thing as a difference between truth and lies, and there is such a thing as a difference between good and evil. And I constantly come back to that.
Here, Judd was bringing to the foreground for Marcy something that can get lost in the excesses of postmodernism. From where I sit, postmodernism has made a healthy contribution to the world, which is to remind us that all of us are actively interpreting the world. None of us is purely objective, so there are many valid and useful ways to interpret the same facts. But a good deal of postmodernism has gone beyond this. Instead of saying there are many ways to interpret the same facts, extreme postmodernists claim that there are no facts, that everything is subjective, everything is relative, and there is nothing objectively true or false, nothing morally good or bad. I don't know if Judd made this precise distinction, but it was this unhealthy expression of postmodernism that he was criticizing and that had a deep impact on Marcy.
When I was working on the Ukrainian night, Yaroslav Hertsakh, who's a friend and colleague of mine and one of the best historians in Ukraine, kept saying, the Euromaidan should have been Tony's revolution. This would have been his revolution. And I thought about that the whole time. I thought he would have been there. This was so, it would have been his moment. And it was one of the many layers of additional tragedy that came on top of his untimely death.
What is it about the Maidan that would have been his?
It was the moment that was almost post-postmodern in the sense of anti-postmodern. It was a return to that moment, really in dissident philosophy, but that pre-1989 moment when things like truth and meaning and subjectivity and good versus evil had real meaning again, where people were willing to stake themselves on it. And it was being acted out in front of our eyes. And when I was in Kyiv in spring 2014, I think all of us there felt that Tony should have been there.
I think it's important to note here something that Marcy doesn't make a big deal of in our conversation. She has chosen in her life not just to write or speak from a distance, but to visit Ukraine herself during intensely turbulent times, including war, thus herself choosing the type of moral responsibility that Judd stood for.
It was just a few years after his death. I mean, he should have been there. He should have been there. He would have had so much to say. It would have been just the right person.
Jut's ideas and spirit showed up in Ukraine shortly after the Maidan. One day, Marcy received an email from a Ukrainian friend inviting her to discuss Jut's work in a Skype call.
And there's the screen, and there's Yaroslav and his students at this classroom at the Ukrainian Catholic University. And then the screen splits, and there's another screen that opens. Mykola, who was this student, had decided voluntarily to join the army. And this was the beginning of the war in the Donbass. And so he had put his dissertation on hold, and he went off to fight in the Donbass. And he was recruited, after being in the field for some time, he was quickly recruited into military intelligence. He's brilliant. It makes perfectly good sense. And he had Tony's books with him that he had been reading. And he was in an unmarked Soviet era military bunker, in his uniform, in an undisclosed location. And he was Skyping in because he really wanted to talk about Tony's work. And so this young man came on the screen, and we weren't asking any questions about where he was or what he was doing. He had Tony's books there in this bunker with him. And when I saw him on the screen, when I saw that screen split, I had to stop myself from crying, because I thought, oh my God, Tony would have loved this. Would have meant everything to Tony. I mean, he would have loved if he could have lived to see what his work meant to these young people living through war and revolution and looking back on the 20th century, the moral questions, the political questions, the questions about good and evil and truth and falsehood, and can we get to a better world? That would have meant everything to him.
Yeah, that's remarkable. I want to go back to the good and evil and true and false. It's very important distinctions. And you described how different that is from big portions of postmodernism. And let's relate that to the war in Ukraine now. And the way I want to ask you about this is, if any of us were not to know the difference between good and evil, or not to know that things actually happen, there are actually facts there, how might we look at Russia and Ukraine today? How are many people looking at it because of that?
Now, and that's something that's terrifying, and that Tony didn't live to see. I mean, Tony's critique of postmodernism, of this, is there really an ontological distinction between truth and falsehood? Because really meaning is fluid and it flickers, and signifiers play around with other signifiers. His critique was directed at intellectuals. His critique was directed at academics. His critique was directed at certain historiographical trends, at self-absorbed, narcissistic, philosophers who sit in cafes and talk about how meaning is fluid and flickers. He did not live to see the post-truth era. He didn't live to see this sort of grotesque moment. And this was perhaps one reason why it was easy for me to be so enamored of so much of this philosophy, because you weren't seeing people actually get killed. You weren't seeing Putin actually play with it, or I wasn't at the time. It wasn't really until the Maidan in 2013, 2014, where this idea of post-truth, this weaponization of what was arguably a philosophical movement that originates in the critical sensibility of the left, but now is going to be co-opted as a weapon of the right, to say that, well, who knows, okay, there was a plane that fell from the air and 298 people were suddenly killed and there were bodies scattered on the ground. I don't know. I mean, maybe the Ukrainians shot it down, or maybe somebody was trying to assassinate Putin, or maybe it was all a provocation and it was a plane that the CIA had stuffed with corpses, who were bodies that were already dead, and they just wanted to make it seem like the Russians had done something, or maybe this, or maybe that. And well, who really knows? I mean, certainly we can't possibly know, so why pursue any accountability? I mean, that kind of absolutely grotesque, gruesome. I mean, I don't think Derrida could have ever possibly imagined where something like that was going. I mean, these were sets of ideas that very much came from a sensibility that was focused on trying to undermine the kinds of absolutist truth claims that had led us to Nazism and Stalinism, not anticipating Putinism and not anticipating Trump.
Right. So there are things that actually happened. There are facts that can be empirically verified versus, well, there's many interpretations of this. There's endless interpretations. There's no way to know. We'll never know. And so what purpose does that serve Russia to do that?
I mean, I think what Tony would say is that all of that, is a way of evading responsibility. The word responsibility was very important to him when he writes that book, The Burden of Responsibility. For him, maintaining that distinction is about responsibility. It's about taking responsibility. And everything he did and all the choices he made, and you can argue over whether individual ones were good or bad, but they were made with a sense of responsibility and a sense that intellectuals bear that burden, in particular, perhaps, for taking responsibility. I mean, Putin clearly takes no responsibility for anything. Trump takes no responsibility for anything. You're literally living for Putin, you're in this world in which other people's lives have no weight for you. They don't matter at all. If nothing matters, it's just the nihilism is staggering. But if nothing matters, then you have a free hand, then there are no constraints.
Let's underline the point again. Postmodernism, of which Marcy was enamored early in her career, when taken to an extreme, leads you to a very dangerous place. If there is no such thing as true or false, if good and bad simply don't exist, if everything is simply a matter of perspective, then it really doesn't matter what you do with your life. So why take responsibility for anything? And why object to anything?
Then you really are in this Dostoevskian world in which everything is permitted. And this is what has happened. I mean, Trump believes that everything is permitted him. He doesn't believe that there are any constraints.
Right. Let's talk about how liberals can interpret things like this. And I'll read you another quote from Thinking the 20th Century, where Tony writes, "What was lacking was a historical example through which to grasp the significance of contemporary events. Paradoxically, the more liberal the observer, the more democratic his or her country, the harder it was to make sense of Stalin's behavior." And I wonder if we might say something similar today, let's just say about the full-scale invasion 2 years ago, where you don't have a way of going, "I can't even understand this happening."
No, I think that that's very much the case. I mean, there is a sense of, I mean, Hegel would talk about quantity turning into quality, or changes in scale becoming changes in kind, where something is just so grotesque as to be unimaginable and you can't get your mind around it. And that's definitely in different ways, happened with both Stalin and Putin. And there's no You, it can't be understood in a kind of realpolitik, rational actor way. I mean, Putin is destroying Russia. He will burn through all his country's resources and bleed through his entire population until somebody brings him down. Now, you can say, well, in his own way, he has his own interest. He wants to take over territory. He wants to kill people. He doesn't mind if everybody gets killed and you reduce the whole city to rubble as long as you claim victory. But at that point, you are expanding the definition of rationality to make it so expansive as to be effectively meaningless. Because really, it's just pure nihilism. And it's very hard for liberals to grasp nihilism because we want things to make sense. I mean, liberalism always contained the vulnerability of its premise of rationality. It comes out of the Enlightenment. It's an Enlightenment political philosophy, that assumes that all things being equal, people will act rationally.
Think of this as a case of mistaken identity. If I'm a liberal who values rationality, I don't just think of myself as a rational person. I assume that everyone else is just like me, using reason to make choices. I mistake other people for me. Why do I do this? From the view of adult development, it's a matter of capacity. I have not yet developed the capacity to recognize that different people occupy vastly different worldviews and have vastly different motivation. It just never occurs to me.
But all things are never equal. And unfortunately, people act irrationally all the time.
Right. So you have this tremendous blindness. And I want to tie this to another quote of his related to imagination and have you relate it to the current war. He writes, "Those who got the 20th century right, whether in anticipation like Kafka or as contemporary observers, had to be able to imagine a world for which there was no precedent. Mm-hmm. They had to suppose that this unprecedented and ostensibly absurd situation was actually the case, rather than supposing with everyone else that it was grotesquely unthinkable." I want to have you talk about that, not just about the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, but let's say if Russia defeats Ukraine, there are other things it could do that many of my friends and our colleagues in the United States don't imagine. So what else is possible?
Now, and what Tony says there, I think, is a deep lesson that I think many, many historians have with us all the time. I mean, all of our students are always asking us, you know, why didn't all the Jews leave, you know, before 1933? Why didn't they leave in 1933? Didn't they know? The idea that you would build what Arendt calls factories for the purpose of producing corpses was so inconceivable. Until it happened, it was absolutely unimaginable. The entire Soviet experiment was arguably the largest, most far-reaching, and deepest penetrating social engineering experiment ever performed on mankind. It was inconceivable before it was carried out. The kind of terror that Stalin carried out was unimaginable before it happened, and in some ways unimaginable even as it was happening. And Hegel talks about the owl of Minerva. It's only looking back that we can even take anything in. This is how meaning only comes in retrospect, because not only can we not grasp it in real time, but it's impossible to anticipate. You know, and I say that as someone who I feel like I've taken that lesson very deeply, which doesn't mean that I think I know what's happening or I know what's going to come, but I have an awareness that I don't know. Like in November 2016, when Trump won the election, and I was first lying on the floor of my office at Yale, throwing up into a plastic bag, and I felt like there was this moment of terror and paralysis. You know, and then I felt like my colleagues kind of split into two groups, roughly speaking. You know, and maybe this is just my own biographical experience, because they're all my, you know, all the Americanist people who are kind of focused in their work in different disciplines on what's happening in our own country, and then my whole Slavicist world and all my East Europeanist colleagues. And to use a very rough generalization, I felt like the Americanists were like, okay, this is bad. This is very, very bad. But, you know, we are the world's strongest liberal democracy. You know, we have a long tradition. You know, we have checks and balances. We will get through this. And checks and balances became like a yoga mantra. I felt like it was like, okay, breathe in, checks and balances, breathe out, checks and balances. I didn't know anybody who was happy. I mean, I wasn't part of those circles in which anybody was happy, but there were the Americanist by and large, I felt like, okay, we're going to get through it. We have checks and balances. Whereas most of my Slavicist friends who work on Eastern Europe, you know, understood that this could be the end of the world. And my feeling was like, my God, we're like people on the Titanic who are like walking around saying, oh, our ship can't sink. You know, other ships can sink, but we've got the best ship. We've got the strongest ship. We've got the fanciest ship. Our ship can't sink. And what you know as a historian, and perhaps especially as a historian of a place like Eastern Europe that's just been mired in blood and catastrophe, that there is no such thing as a ship that can't sink.
Right.
Any ship can sink.
Right. In the community of non-historians, of which I am a part, whether or not you think that the ship can sink depends maybe on your own life experience, largely on your own personality type, how much anxiety you have, how much you in the future. My sense would be, among historians, you have a range of personality types and personal experiences. But if you have studied the 20th century, or if you had studied 14, 15, 16, earlier centuries of of violence and devastation, you would say, well, of course this can happen. Mm-hmm. And that might be one of the virtues of studying the past, is that you can do that. Let me just take a slight related tangent to ask you about within the 20th century, one of the things that stood out for me in Tony's writing, and this I did not know, was Europe was shocked by World War I. Mm-hmm. And then you have Stefan, is it Zweig, mm-hmm. who was a very plugged in observer, who was shocked by that, shocked by World War II, because even then we think of that as this bloody century, but there was a period of time when they had peace for a period of time. So I wondered if you could just speak to that part of the 20th century that was even surprised.
We forget that now. We forget what an extraordinary, unimaginable upheaval World War I was. It was also something that was inconceivable until it happened. Previously, Europeans had thought about wars as things that happened between armies. World War I was the first total war for Europeans, in the sense of encompassing not just militaries, but whole populations. When Gabriele Princip assassinated Franz Ferdinand, who was the heir to the Habsburg throne, and Vienna makes this ultimatum to Serbia, and the Habsburg Empire ends up declaring war in Serbia, and then the Tsarist Empire jumps in on the side of Serbia, and the German Empire jumps in on the side of the Habsburg Empire, and soon everybody has jumped in. Nobody has any idea what's going to happen. You know, in some sense, it's a shock to everybody. You know, and 4 years later, you have Europe has just been turned into ashes. You have four great empires that have essentially gone up in flames. The German Empire has fallen. The Habsburg Empire has fallen. The Ottoman Empire has fallen. And the Tsarist Empire has fallen. The whole map of Europe was redrawn. You know, and that was a catastrophe on a scale that nobody had previously experienced. And we forget about that because then it's overshadowed by the Second World War.
Right. So he wasn't ignoring history. He was making a certain interpretation of it that unfortunately didn't play out very well for him or the world.
Yes. Now, he's a tragic figure for that reason. He really is a tragic figure because, you know, you can mobilizing what you know to the best of your ability to make the best decision at the moment, and it can still be a catastrophe.
Yeah. And one of the lessons I'm getting from this is not, and I'm speaking to my listeners here, to freak out, to lose your sense of center and grounding, or to give up your yoga practice. Just don't use it for the reasons that Marcy mentioned. Use it for other reasons. But there is a sobriety about the contingency of life and of history, and being able to draw from the past that awareness that we don't know what's going to happen, A, and B, we are agents of history ourselves, and we can make choices. That's a lesson I draw from Tony's life. It's a lesson I draw from your life and work.
Well, I would highlight these two things in the context of Tony's work. You know, one of them is the first thing you spoke to is epistemological modesty.
She means modesty about what you can know. Instead of being certain about something, you realize, yeah, I don't know for sure. You're not sure that everything will turn out well, but you're also not sure everything will go wrong. This is not a mood of despair. It's an acceptance of uncertainty.
You know, what I feel like I know as a historian, you know, and what terrified me in 2016 is not that I thought I know what will happen. It's that I thought I know what can happen. I know what could happen. Journalists always want to know what's going to happen tomorrow. And in the past 10 years, I've spent a lot of time talking to journalists, and I'm always laughing at this because I say historians' best case scenario with good sources, if we do our job very well, we can explain what has already happened.
At best.
We can't tell you what's going to happen next. At best, we can't tell you what's going to happen next week or next month. But what I think, you know, Tony would say is what history should teach us is a sense of what can happen, which tends to be much more expansive than what we could have imagined.
This is very different from the way most of us view history. We think of history as the past, and because it's the past, we shouldn't assume it tells us anything about the future. What Marcy's saying is that actually, although history is by no means destiny, if we study it, we can see future scenarios we otherwise might ignore, we otherwise might assume could never possibly happen, like the events in Ukraine in February of 2022.
Nobody was imagining this full-scale invasion. It seems crazy. You know, this a full-scale land invasion in Europe in the 21st century was beyond what anyone could imagine. This is why the Europeans now are scrambling, because they don't even have a defense industry that's producing enough weapons to give to the Ukrainians, because it was outside the realm of everyone's imagination. So what you should know is not what will happen, but you should have an appreciation for what can happen, and that it's probably beyond what you can imagine at the time. And this sense, which I take with me from Tony literally every day, I mean, I miss him every day. I think I wish his voice were still here, is this sense of responsibility. You know, is this sense that we have to step up? I'm not someone who particularly enjoys being political. I'm an intellectual historian. That means I work mostly on things like the history of literature, the history of philosophy. I would prefer to be writing about poetry and novels and philosophers and phenomenology. And now I'm out there every day, you know, in a way I never could have imagined, pleading for with Americans, with Germans, to immediately send lethal weapons to Ukraine. Now, this is not a position I ever could have imagined myself in. It's not the position. It seems I was a teenage peace activist. My great grandparents were pogrom victims, you know, of Ukrainians a century or so ago. I grew up in a Jewish community where anything connected to Germans was anathema. You know, I went to Abby Hoffman's memorial service wearing peace sign earrings and a tie-dye t-shirt. And now I go to Germans and plead for them to immediately send all possible lethal weapons to Ukrainians. And I do that without feeling that I'm a very different person, or even that my values have changed, because I feel like that's my responsibility at the moment.
And you've made trips to Ukraine in wartime.
Yes, I have. And I'm not a brave person.
One thing I want to make sure we just touch upon is that there is a widely shared understanding in the United States, I don't know Europe as well, that the reason to support Ukraine is simply for the sake of the Ukrainian people. Those poor Ukrainians, those courageous Ukrainians, let's help them win. Let's help them preserve their country. And I just want to give you a chance to offer perspective that maybe more is at stake than just Ukrainians.
I wish it were not the case that more is at stake, but much more is at stake. You know, arguably that's more than enough, you know, is to protect innocent people in a way that we would like to be doing every day all around the world and never do a good enough job at. But I actually do believe that we're a hair's breadth from the Third World War.
This is a strong statement. When you hear this, is there a part of you that thinks, no way, not going to happen, things will turn out okay? You know what? This may just be the voice of the liberal modernist mind that, as we've seen, has big blinders on when it comes to anticipating horrors and atrocities.
And I think that Poles certainly know that. The Latvians know that. The Estonians know that. The Lithuanians know that. You know, they know that that war could cross their border at any single moment.
Right. The counter argument that I can imagine someone saying is, if we support Ukraine, we're going to increase the odds of a new world war. And you're saying something different.
Yes, I unfortunately do not believe that's true. The whole talk about, well, if we support Ukraine, it will be seen as escalation and Putin won't like escalation and we might provoke him. And that's all assuming that we're in some kind of rational actor paradigm and that we're playing this game as if it were a chess tournament and everybody had agreed on the rules. But what happens when somebody comes in the room and takes the chessboard and throws it at the ceiling and scatters all the pieces? Putin is already provoked. There's no reason the fact that he has nuclear weapons is not a reason not to escalate. It's a reason that that regime has to be totally, utterly brought down.
Yeah, maybe we should spend a little bit less time trying to help Putin feel safe in his own mind. Reflections. What does it feel like listening to Marcy share her story? What new possibilities does this open up for you and how you understand the world? Let me share a few thoughts about what I learned from Marcy as she described what she learned from Tony Judt. First, there is this dimension of human experience called moral responsibility. When you learn that a state or organization is committing horrible atrocities, what do? Do you turn a blind eye toward it because your ideology tells you to? After all, if you're not on this side, then you must be with the enemy. Or do you ignore or minimize it because, gosh, this just can't be happening in a rational world? There must be a mistake. There must be some other explanation. Or do you take responsibility to speak out, to speak up, using whatever skills, assets, and approach best suit who you uniquely are? And are you willing to risk loss of status and friendship, and maybe even your life, to do this? Second, there is a lesson here about history. History is not just describing what happened in the past, although this is absolutely essential, and unfortunately, many of our history classes today ignore it or avoid it. It's using our understanding of history to recognize what just might happen in the future. History isn't destiny, but it can help us anticipate future scenarios we might otherwise ignore or overlook. Third, let's see the postmodern mind clearly. In the realm of human history, it's brand new, and it has a big gift and a big downside. On the one hand, it allows us to realize that the world doesn't just include objective facts. It also includes perspectives. Different people interpret the same events very differently, and that is because we have interiors, we have depths. The world is not one big flatland. This is the gift of the postmodern mind. However, it also has a downside. At its extreme, the postmodern mind does not just say that there is more to the human world than truth and falsehood. It says there actually is no such thing as true or false, which as a guiding assumption to life is not particularly helpful, because it leads us not only to complete confusion, but also to the evasion of responsibility. Finally, I want to repeat something I said earlier about our identities, who we take ourselves to be. It's actually very easy to go through life making choices by asking ourselves, does this sound like me? Is this something that I would do? If we ask ourselves these questions and the answer is yes, I do it. And if the answer is no, I don't. Really simple. Marcy's story reminds us that there is a different question we could be asking ourselves. What do I feel responsible to do? To which I might add, what is needed here and what am I being called to do? The thing about these questions is that they take us out of our identities, out of who we take ourselves to be. For Marcy, that has meant lobbying German leaders to send military aid to Ukraine. Is this who she's taken herself to be all these years? No, not at all. But she feels a responsibility to do it, so she stretches beyond her long-held identity. This is one of the ways that we human beings can grow. Thanks for listening. Once again, this is the second to last episode of Season 1. We will return with Season 2 in the fall. If you believe in this show, like what you're hearing, or simply don't know what to do with yourself for the next 30 seconds, please subscribe to the podcast and leave me a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This show is produced in Detroit by Zach Rosen.